Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Gwyn Sheltimer, my co-host Felicity Sidnell-Reed, and our guest this week, Bernie Morin. Each week at this time, we visit with an author or sometimes an editor or publisher from our region. We hope to find out a little about his or her life and what prompts them to write. We give them an opportunity to read some of their work for us. And this week, we're very pleased to have Bernie Morin join us. Welcome, Bernie.
Thank you.
Bernard Morin was a film producer, director of television and radio advertising in Toronto for about 20 years until the early 90s, when his world was turned completely upside down. He had purchased a summer house that he eventually discovered was heavily haunted. The journey that ensued as a result of that realization changed his life. Bernard had never thought of himself as a writer, but he couldn't deny his fascination with the life of that offending spirit. This led him to write a short story, which was then put away for many years. Much later, two friends encouraged him to write the story into a play, or perhaps a movie. 6 years of revisions finally culminated in the play entitled In Continuum. It was produced this past year for 89.7 FM with the assistance of the Northumberland Players Guild and can be found under the list of podcasts on the station's website. So tell us, Bernie, tell us the story of your haunted house. Do you still live there and is it still haunted?
I do not live there. I sold it several years ago. I don't believe it's still haunted, but then I haven't been able to visit it. But we did quite a thorough job, so I'm sure it's clear. The intention was to leave it clear. I was looking for a cottage or a summer place, and I had looked for a number of years and discovered that the best places with the best aspect, in other words, facing west on good water, were usually white elephants and weren't particular cottages. They never seemed to come up. They stayed in families a long time. And I came across this one in the Kawartha Lakes north of Peterborough that just stunned me. It was such a powerful experience just seeing it. The three of us who were in the boat looking at it were literally bowled over by the power of this. And not really clear what that was. You know, I found out much later it had been a native healing ground.
Oh, wow.
As many islands in that lake had been. But there was a very definite healing energy there, which attracts spirits, as it turned out. There were initially eight of us, what I call an intentional community of friends. And I noticed after a while there were unusual things happening. When I started talking with the others, I realized that it wasn't just me. Other people were having experiences, but no one was really talking about it. And when we did start talking about it, we started to notice more than we had before. So we called in a channel and a man who worked with her to see if we could channel out whoever this was, because there were some really confusing pieces in it. And in the end, he wasn't able to move it. So we had to call in a shaman medicine man from the nearby reserve. And this man did move it. But the meeting of this man and the story of how all this came about is formed the play.
Wow. Very different story. So did you have to then kind of put a name to this ghost, maybe research who or what it was?
Well, we didn't know until the first channeling whether it was male or female. I had seen remnants of a male, and so I assumed it was male. And then when it was channeled out, it turned out to be female. Well, it turned out there wasn't one. There was actually three, and the play only deals with two spirits in total. So I was fascinated, like, what period in history is this person? Because this is really a person without a body for me. Mm-hmm. And why here? Why is this person, why are these people stuck here? What is the glue that keeps them in this spot? Why is one benevolent and why is the other one nasty? And the house had a particular history. It was a significant piece of architecture. Didn't know that until architects came to visit and said, oh my gosh, this is a Frank Darling building. I wonder if anybody knows this is here. So Frank Darling and being Pearson Darling Architects in Toronto did a lot of very significant buildings at U of T and bank buildings and all that, and did McLaughlin's house in Oshawa. So we suddenly realized there was more of a connection to history here than just a grand summer place that had fallen into a lot of disrepair. It really culminated in, okay, who was this built for? And I kept asking around the lake for, you know, bits of rumors or history that people knew about, and were there other people on the lake that were related? And I kept hearing all these disparate stories that did not make a cohesive story for me. Then some of us had seen things happening in the house, and none of that seemed to go together. It wasn't until the shaman came, and I was able to simply say to him, without divulging anything, what happened on the stairwell? And boom, he said it. And I said, okay, what happened over here? And we came through with the whole image that people had seen and gave the whole history and was able to tune into the people.
Gives me shivers.
Well, I can tell you, living through it was really something else. It changed how I see. You know, it changed how I perceive. A house may be very attractive and phenomenal to visit, but if there's an odd feeling in it, do we pay more attention to the feeling or to the physical attributes of the building? And how much credence do you give the feeling? I mean, I suddenly realized there was a whole element of life. It's like lifting up the carpet and discovering there's a whole world under your carpet and not just dirt. So it was a great process.
Wow. Now, of course, bringing it back to really practical things, the writing of it, were you a writer before this story appeared?
Or I was not.
Was this started you?
I had worked in advertising as a producer, and I worked with writers very collaboratively, and I wasn't so much a writer, but they would say, okay, what do you think of this? And I was able to say, okay, that line doesn't play well. So that was the extent of it, really. I'd done a few other pieces, but nothing informal, you know, as a formal pursuit at all. It was just kind of incidental.
So is that why you think it took 6 years to write it?
It took longer than that.
Did it?
Initially, when this woman was cleared, it was a woman who was the main protagonist, I was fascinated by what it must be like to be her. Found out when she was channeled out, I got a sense of her voice, and she had a certain haughtiness about her. And I thought, okay, she was raised with privilege, so I can expect some of that. But there was this enormous anger, and I thought, okay, what's the source of the anger? And I discovered as I was writing that I could feel everything about her.
Cool.
And so the words, the verbiage, it all poured out. Then we stumbled across the family crypt at Mount Pleasant Cemetery, totally by accident, and saw the plate with her name next to it. I have changed the names in the play because I don't have permission from the family, and some of it is fictionalized because it needed to be. And I've changed the name of the residence because I don't know the current owners, and nor do I want them to be flooded by, you know, hey, I hear you have a ghost.
Well, would you read us some?
Certainly. Although this started initially as a formal play, in transcribing it for radio, you rely on narrative to create the ground and the description and all that. And there's certainly a visual portion to this which has to be handled with words, but not with dialogue necessarily. So this is Paul, who is describing actually the events that happened to me. So my name in this is Paul. Okay. The story I'm about to share with you describes a very bizarre series of events that occurred in the summer of 1988. My name is Paul, and this is my part of that story. 3 years earlier, I decided to find a refuge from the frantic pace of Toronto, and most especially from a crisis that surrounded me everywhere I looked. But more of that later. My search took me to the Kawartha Lakes north of Peterborough and to a decaying old mansion on an island. It was known as Island House and had fallen into significant disrepair. My logical side questioned my sanity. But as I looked at it from the boat, something clutched and held onto my heart. It was as if the ground were shaking, yet I was on the water. How could that happen? Until I got to see it a day later, I kept wondering how bad it would be inside, and I would still say yes. Well, bad it was. The ribs had leaked for years, and the air was sharp with the smell of mildew, bats, damp wood, and varnish. But then there was that massive living room, 1,500 square feet of French doors, beam ceiling, and a grand piano with legs that were carved into owls. The foyer alone was the size of a normal living room. The dining room could easily seat 40 people. All three principal rooms overlooked the lake. Though I concede that I was smitten and magnetized to it right from that first day, in retrospect, I have to acknowledge it was a vague sense of despair about it that was difficult to ascribe or even articulate. In the end, my ideas of rescuing it were turned right around on me. I would become the one in need of rescue. But I'm getting ahead of myself. In the first 2 years, a small group of five friends had coalesced around Island House, captivated by the lake itself, but seduced by the sheer volume of decaying grace we were blessed to inhabit. Gradually, essential repairs were accomplished, and though the list always seemed endless, it did move forward. In the second year, my partner Stasio passed away. I was devastated, in a word. Yet Island House held me fast in its demanding embrace and helped me to heal in a million silent ways that only lake people know. We are now down to four: Ricky, Scott, Adam, and myself. The following year, unusual things, events, happenings, I can't quite find the word for them, let's say bizarre happenings, started to occur. My first recollection was lying on the floor in the foyer in front of the wood stove on a chilly fall day. I thought I detected movement out of the corner of my eye. As I turned to look, I saw a Victorian-style man's ankle boot and the first few inches of striped morning pants, clearly from another era. The foot stepped past my head and then disappeared completely. At first, I assumed it was the result of stress and a significant lack of sleep, until other occurrences became repeat performances, daily, in fact. However, early one Saturday morning, about 3 a.m., it all started to escalate radically. A thunderstorm was rolling down the lake, illuminating the many islands and waterways with each flash of lightning. I listened to the high-pitched calls of the loons as they warned each other of the impending change in the weather. And inside Island House, the craziness always seemed to be amplified during storms. I was unable to fall into a deep sleep, but not because of the storm. I enjoyed storms, but because I was restless and felt trapped in that space between unconscious sleep and vague half-dreams. Then a very loud knocking on my bedroom door snapped me to attention, followed by this creepy woman's voice yelling at me.
Okay. And we're all set up to hear what happens next. But first, we're going to have to take a short break. We've been talking with Bernie Morin, who's written a radio play, which can actually be listened to from podcast at the studio. So thank you, Bernie, and let's take our break.